I'm Samir Patel, editor-in-chief at Quanta Magazine. Our mission at Quanta is to cover what we call basic or fundamental research in science and math. That means the kind of work that's driven by curiosity and discovery and the search for knowledge. We're interested in how and why everything around us works the way that it does. On our brand new show, the Quanta Podcast, you'll meet the writers and editors behind the magazine, and together we'll explore the biggest ideas and the tiniest details. Join me for the Quanta Podcast, your weekly dispatch from the frontiers of science and math.
Four years. That's how long the people of Ukraine have defended their country against the Goliath that is Russia.
4 years that are lost from our lives and that we're never getting back those years.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today we focus on the story of that war.
We'll hear resilience.
None of us knew how long this would last. If someone had told us it would be years, we would have been crushed by the weight of it.
Outright defiance.
If all of us leave, so who's going to live here? This is Putin's main goal. I don't want him to be happy.
And yes, fear and loss.
They are just kids. It's the state's responsibility to bring them home alive and safe.
Reflections on a war heading into its fifth year and more news today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being here this Tuesday.
It began just before sunrise 4 years ago today. A line of Russian armored tanks began advancing toward Kyiv from the north. Cruise missiles rained down on Ukrainian cities. The region had not seen attacks like these since World War II.
So began what Russia's leader Vladimir Putin calls the special military operation, and what the rest of the world calls a full-scale invasion. 4 years on, Kyiv has not fallen.
Ukrainian resistance has proven stronger than Moscow expected. In the capital, near nightly bombardments still rob residents of not just sleep, but peace, and war rages on in regions along the country's south and east.
We begin today's show with some perspective from Ina Sovsun on how the last 4 years have reshaped life in Ukraine. She is a Ukrainian member of parliament with the Holos political party and previously served as Ukraine's deputy minister of education and science. When we spoke earlier today, she talked about her feelings as her country enters the fifth year of this war.
It's a very difficult day for all of us in Ukraine. Emotionally difficult. People are remembering the first night when you wake up to the sounds of the air raid alert, to the sounds of a missile flying over you. And I think the scary part about all of that is how normal all of that has become for all of us. First night, I woke up at 4 a.m. hearing explosions. I was terrified. Now they became a daily, rather nightly reality for all of us. That is just scary. It shouldn't be like that. People shouldn't be getting used to the fact that bombs are flying over their heads.
So after waking up from last night, the most recent night of this war, what were you thinking when you got up this morning?
That it was 4 years of my life that I have spent not in the way I wanted them to be spent. My partner has joined the armed forces the first day of invasion. He has been serving for 4 years now. It has been 4 years that we haven't spent together. It has been 4 years that are lost from our lives and that we're never getting back those years. There are thousands of people who are going through the same, who are split, who are not together. There are unfortunately thousands of those who will never return from this war, who have been killed in action. And this sense of we shouldn't have lived through all of that. That is the main feeling. And the sense of I've been 4 years younger when it all started. My son is 13 now. He was 9 years old when the big war started. All his childhood, basically, the time he will remember, will be the wartime and him running to the shelter at school. That is just terrifying to admit that this is something that we are going through and we don't see any end to this so far.
I know your partner is out on the front lines, as you said, and there are months that go by where you're not seeing him. What do you hear from him, and how regularly do you speak with him?
Well, probably more often than others, but there are people who go to positions and then they have no ability to talk to their loved ones for days or weeks or months sometimes. But of course, he's very tired, like all of them are. He's very disappointed that it feels like that this war that Russia launched against Ukraine, because Ukraine chose to join the European Union, chose the Western path, this war that is the result of Russia's leadership hatred towards everything the West stands for, that the weight of this war has fallen on the shoulders of so few. My partner being one of them, me by extension as well. So it just feels very unfair.
Can you explain what you mean by falling on the shoulders of so few?
Well, within Ukraine, it's a smaller number of people who are fighting compared to those who are civilians. But it also, it feels like Putin has attacked us at the front line of the West. Over the last couple of months, there were multiple talks, particularly by European leaders, who are saying that we are now, Ukraine now is the first line of defense against Russia's aggression. But at the same time, despite all the aid that has been given, this aid is just not enough for us to withstand this pressure and to prevail in this war. We were given enough to keep on fighting, but we were never given enough to actually win, to actually prevail. So few are actually fighting against this aggression, which is not just aggression against Ukraine. It's the aggression against the global world order. Yet it doesn't feel like this sense of urgency of the situation is felt throughout the world, unfortunately, particularly now when people seem to have gotten used to the fact that there is just war. Doesn't even get to the news any longer globally. But the war is there. Russia's ambitions to disrupt the global world order are still there. It's the reality that people fail to recognize and then fail to respond to that properly.
And you've got to balance that while working on policy as an MP. And as you said, you're also a mother. What has this war meant for your parenting?
Oh, well, the first half a year, of course, the kids were not going to school. They were studying online to an extent possible. Many families chose to move their children outside of the country. And now, after 4 years, of course, the huge challenge for all of us is that we have basically lost the whole generation because it doesn't seem likely that those children will come back to Ukraine. But for those who chose to stay and together with their kids, it has been another challenge because my son goes to school. When there is an air raid alert, which is almost daily reality, the studies are interrupted and they go to the baseline, which is the shelter. So, of course, it influences the quality of education. It influences the mental well-being of the children. The kids going through all of that, it's just terrifying to see that. You know, my son, when there is an air raid alert, he knows which websites to check to see if it's a drone or if it's a missile. And it's just so scary to think that my son had to learn to differentiate between the two. So, of course, we all want that to be over for our kids. As a mother, I can say this. My partner has been on the front line for 4 years now. There is probably one thing that I'm scared more of, that is to have to send my son to the next wave of this war. If the peace that is being established is not stable and is not supported properly, that is something I don't want to live through ever, because that is probably the most scary experience a mother can deal with, is to see your son being sent to the war.
Yeah, I can totally understand that. How do you talk about the future with your son, though, in a way that motivates him?
I tell him he has to study to be better than Russians. That has become a huge motivation.
And what does that mean, actually?
That means, like, when he doesn't want to do math, I am parenting a teenager. I guess many parents listening to us can relate to that. When he doesn't like to do math, I'm telling him that we are together in all of that. And there are people on the front line who are now protecting his life so that he can study and become better, so that we as a country, all of us, become better and we can withstand the Russian pressure in the future. When he really doesn't want to do math, that is my final argument, so to speak.
Practically speaking for you, Madam Minister, what has changed most dramatically in your everyday life since the full-scale invasion?
Well, I don't sleep typically in Kyiv. I can never sleep longer than, let's say, 3 hours. And then I wake up and check the news or wake up from the air raid alert or something like that. Yeah, a lot has changed. I don't even remember the life how it used to be. I only have water and heating the hours that I have electricity. So you have to adjust your schedule. I sometimes take a shower at 3 a.m. because that is the only time I can take a shower.
I'm speaking with Inna Sovsun, a Minister of Parliament in Ukraine. Inna, for several years under the Biden administration, you could see the support from the U.S. get challenged progressively by elements who did not think spending the resources to fight Putin were worth it, to be blunt. How has your worldview changed since the start of the full-scale invasion?
There used to be the belief in, you know, in institutions, in rules, in procedures that are supposed to deliver peace, and they all failed to respond properly. I'll give you a minor example. In December, the Europeans were supposed to seize the Russian assets, which are held in Brussels, and they failed to seize the Russian assets, which would have been a huge blow to the Russian economy, which would have undermined Russia's ability to fund this war. And that was the huge leverage that Europeans had. But they never used that because of internal political debate inside the European Union. The same goes for other friends and partners. It would have been much cheaper, both in terms of money, but also human cost of all of that. Instead of providing humanitarian response and aid in people living in cold, it would have been much cheaper to give Ukraine the capacity to strike into the Russian launching sites and undermine, prevent all those attacks from happening, prevent the attacks that destroyed half of our energy sector. That would have, really stopped the war, unlike the ongoing talks with Putin, which do not really lead to anything so far.
Well, you're starting to touch on there the human toll of this conflict. It has been immense. Recent estimates suggest up to 1.8 million fighters have been killed, wounded, or are missing in the past 4 years alone, not to mention the millions who have fled their homes and are displaced internally or abroad. You told us, how this war has affected you personally, but what has been the toll on the national Ukrainian psyche?
People are, of course, tired and exhausted. People want this to be over, but it doesn't mean that people are ready to give in to any peace deal. That will end up in another war in a year from the peace deal being signed. That is what we are very scared of. We need a peace deal that will make sure that the war will be stopped forever. Only then people will see the future in Ukraine. Only then they will be able to continue living in Ukraine, to come back to Ukraine, to build future there, to build families, to create businesses. All of that requires, general understanding that this is a long-lasting peace. That is what is very much needed right now.
I mean, President Zelensky has been determined to not cede any Ukrainian territory. That's his line in the sand. But can you see a future where the cost to Ukrainians in blood and treasure is so high that the best thing to do for their security is to strike some sort of compromise of territory?
Well, I will rephrase your question. Can the West see the future for the Western rules-based order where one country can force another country to give up part of its territory just because it has the military might to do so? That is not just the question to Ukraine. That is not just Ukraine's future at stake. It's the global order at stake. Will the West be able to stop this terrifying, aggressive state under Putin or not? If Putin prevails in all of that, what is there to stop him from another attack? What is there to stop him from claiming that, Alaska used to be the Russian territory? Or, the Baltics in Europe used to be a part of Russia, so on and so forth. If he is proven to have succeeded with his moves, then what is there to stop him further on? He needs to be stopped. And that is what we are calling you to do together with us, instead of simply giving in to Russia's demand. So I still hope that, after all, the better angels of American souls will prevail and will help us in this war and will not force us into an unjust peace that will just be beneficial to Putin.
Inna Sovsun is a member of parliament in Ukraine with the Holos political party. She's been speaking with us on the fourth anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of her country. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Coming up, 4 years ago, most European Union countries welcomed Ukrainian refugees, offering housing and welfare support. But in the past year, that support has started to fade. We hear why. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine led to the largest forced migration in Europe since the end of the Second World War. Up to a third of the population has been displaced. The vast majority of people fled to Central and Eastern Europe. Most countries in the EU opened their doors to Ukrainian refugees, offering accommodation and welfare benefits. But as the war has dragged on, that support has started to fade. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has more on that.
Victoria Timoshuk fled her son with her 8-year-old daughter 4 months after the war broke out.
It's a front line, and our self-evacuation was so terrible. Everything has been destroyed there.
Timoshuk moved to Cork in the south of Ireland. She thought she'd stay for a few months, she says.
Nobody was prepared for this long-lasting war. And we all thought that we would just stay here for a few months and go back home.
But 4 years on, Timoshuk is still there. Most people are just as friendly as they were in those first few months, she says. But in the last couple of years, far-right activists in Ireland have been aggressively targeting asylum seekers and refugees, blaming them for the country's housing crisis.
Violent demonstrations broke out near Ireland's capital Dublin on Tuesday night, with as many as 2,000 protesters clashing with police.
Far-right extremists encouraged that riot outside a centre hosting asylum seekers last October, with inflammatory posts on social media. Housing experts say Ireland's housing crisis is driven by chronic underinvestment in construction following the financial crash in 2008. Still, last November, the Irish government introduced new rules limiting the amount of time Ukrainian refugees can stay in state-sponsored accommodation. Other EU countries are dialing back their support too.
Obiecałem zakończyć etap bezwarunkowych przywilejów. Dziś to zobowiązanie.
Last week, Poland's right-wing president passed a law ending the special status for Ukrainians that was introduced in 2022. I promised to end the era of unconditional privileges for Ukrainians, and today I'm fulfilling that promise, Karen Nawrotsky said.
The issue of Ukrainians in Poland has become highly politicized.
Olga Tokariuk is with the Ukraine Forum at Chatham House in London.
Especially after the presidential election campaign in Poland last year, when there was a lot of rhetoric from politicians from across the political spectrum, in fact, kind of trying to blame Ukrainians for some domestic problems that Poland has, or trying to say that they're disproportionately using the resources of the state.
Tokariuk says statistics show that Ukrainians contribute more to the Polish system through their taxes than they get in state support. These upcoming cutbacks in social welfare and medical care will hit vulnerable Ukrainians the most, she says. In Germany, which hosts the highest number of Ukrainian refugees in Europe, some benefits are also being taken away. Tokariuk says those cuts could hit hard because in Germany, it's much more difficult to get a job.
This has to do with how the system in Germany works, that Ukrainians just cannot access the labour market there immediately because they are expected to learn the language, they are expected to integrate, and the German labour market is much more closed than it is in Poland or in Czech Republic or in some other countries.
That struggle to find work is one that Daria Mischerikova knows very well.
When they heard that I was Ukrainian, they would send me to warehouses, just some very low-qualified jobs.
Ms. Cherikova, who's originally from Donbass in eastern Ukraine, spent 3 years in the Netherlands after the war broke out. She's a journalist and speaks several languages.
I was like, maybe you would at least take a look at my CV. I can speak like 5 languages fluently. I have a pretty solid work experience. No, like I say, yeah, send us your CV. When I did, I only received emails, we don't have a job for you.
The biggest worry for many Ukrainians, though, is the EU's plan to scrap the Temporary Protection Directive, which was introduced after Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022. It means Ukrainians have access to housing, education, and medical care in the EU. But come next March, that comes to an end. Ylva Johansson, the EU Special Envoy for Ukrainians in Europe, tells me it was only ever meant to be temporary.
Most of the Ukrainians are now well integrated into society. They go to work, they earn their own money, their children go to school. They are not really vulnerable refugees anymore.
Olga Tokariuk at Chatham House, who is Ukrainian, says that's just not true.
I know for sure that there are a lot of people who are vulnerable, you know, single mothers with young children, with children with disabilities, people from the occupied territories, elderly people. What will be offered to them?
Johansson, the EU Special Envoy, says the focus now should be on empowering Ukrainians rather than treating them as vulnerable refugees.
The dual approach that we need to have, on one hand, helping Ukrainians to integrate, to earn their own money, to go to school, to learn the language, and at the same time, preparing for those that would like to go back and return to Ukraine.
And some Ukrainians have already gone back.
2 weeks after my return, there was a mass attack, and it was pretty scary, and it was pretty harsh.
Daria Mischerikova moved back to Kyiv from the Netherlands last August. The attacks were terrifying at first, she says, but slowly she's gotten used to them.
I live in a high-rise building. There is no normal cellar here, like basement, where I can hide. We just stay. I cover myself with an anti-missile blanket. And that's it. I don't go anywhere. When it's too bad, I sit in the hallway.
Ms. Cherikova is working as a journalist once again, which makes her happy, she says. And she plans to stay for as long as she can.
I always liked Ukraine. And if all of us leave, so who's going to live here? This is Putin's main goal. I don't want him to be happy.
Why should I live anywhere else, she says. This is my country. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
Coming up later in the show, we look at the heavy toll the war has taken on soldiers and their families in Russia.
This is musician Luc Mwandranze Kariuja, a singer and composer from the island of Reunion off the coast of East Africa. The raw percussion and call and response is typical of the musical style in Reunion, known as Maloya, which Kariuja celebrates on his debut solo album, Mombalo. Maloya is now celebrated on the island, which is an overseas territory of France. In the 1960s and 70s, though, it was considered protest music, and the French government banned it. Some politicians believe the music, which is sung in Creole, not French, included messages that were a threat to their rule over the island. Thankfully, by the time Kariuja was born in 1997, the ban on Maloya had long been lifted. The music is often used to talk about social issues facing Reunion, like unemployment. Kariuja instead embeds Maloya with other themes, from the spiritual to the everyday mundane activities of life. Taking us to the bottom of the hour is his tune Balmai, a song about the times he spent feeding the farm animals with his granddad. You're with the World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. 160,000. That was one of the very first numbers we reported in our coverage of the war in Ukraine. That was in 2022. 160,000 was the number of Russian troops that had taken months to gather along Ukraine's border on the eve of the full-scale invasion.
4 years later, numbers still tell us parts of the story of this war that sometimes people can't. The Ukrainian army began this war with nearly 200,000 troops. Now the Ukrainian Armed Forces, or UAF, has approximately 900,000 active personnel. They are supported by more than 1 million in reserve and paramilitary roles.
On the Russian side,
Russia continued to introduce large numbers of troops into the theater.
The number of people serving in the Russian military at the start of the full-scale invasion, 1.3 million. Today, in addition to a similar number of active duty personnel, Russia has 2 million reservists and a 250,000 paramilitary members. So despite heavy losses, mobilization and recruitment have increased the size of Russia's forces.
The losses, though, those numbers are staggering. Just a few weeks ago, we reported that if you look at military losses for both sides put together, the number of soldiers missing, wounded, or killed so far is 1.8 million. That number is expected to reach 2 million by spring.
In Ukraine, those killed, wounded, or missing in the military have reached somewhere between 500 and 600,000. If you look at just fallen Ukrainian fighters, estimates as of December were between 100,000 and 140,000 dead. Of course, the invasion started with civilian losses in Ukraine.
An all-day barrage of Russian missiles striking mostly civilian targets throughout the country.
According to the most recent reporting from the UN, close to 16,000 Ukrainian civilians have been killed in the war. The loss of civilians on the Russian side is also immense.
As we mentioned a moment ago, the number of people serving in Russia's military has not been diminished, despite all the soldiers who have lost their lives. Feeding Russia's war machine has taken a heavy toll on the soldiers and their families. Levi Bridges has our story.
There's a short music video circulating on the Russian internet these days where soldiers at war plead with their mothers not to worry about them. In the video, a young soldier wearing an olive green tactical helmet flashes a peace sign and appears to sway to the beat in a tall pine forest. Mama, don't worry, we're alive, the song goes. And by the grace of God, we'll stay that way. Mom should probably be worried, though. More than a million Russian troops have been killed, wounded, or gone missing. That's almost double Ukraine's losses. I found a TikTok video showing a family shoveling dirt over a soldier's coffin with a broken heart emoji superimposed over the screen. Many soldiers' bodies are never recovered. Russians post messages on the app Telegram in groups dedicated to helping people find the missing. One mother posts a video in her kitchen, crying and wiping her eyes with a handkerchief. The authorities promised they'd find my son, but they haven't turned up anything, she says. Many of these messages end with a question. Can anyone out there help me find my kid? In the first years after Russia's full-scale invasion, mothers took to the streets in cities like Moscow, demanding the government bring their families home. One woman whose husband was sent to the war told the news outlet Current Time that most Russians fighting in Ukraine don't want to be there. They have families, careers, future plans they left behind. They shouldn't be off at war, she says. But today, vocalizing disapproval is becoming much rarer. The authorities have intimidated and silenced these groups of mothers and wives by arresting some of their members. You mostly find signs of dissent online now.
Let's do this one.
This one?
Yeah.
God, this is hard.
My partner, Lana, and I read through the comments today in a social media post about a skinny young conscript from Russia who died in Ukraine.
No, he's just a little boy.
People commenting on these posts often praise the soldiers for their bravery defending the homeland.
Daniil was such a bright and kind soul, the kindest guy in the world. We mourn together with the loved ones of everyone who fell in battle.
But dig deep through the more patriotic prose, and you find some critics. One guy says Russia's biggest enemy isn't Ukraine, it's the guy sitting in a bunker somewhere. I'm guessing he's talking about Putin. Then there's this comment.
Why are they sending young men to the special military operation? They are just kids. It's the state's responsibility to bring them home alive and safe.
The loss of all these young men can scar a community. Russia's military has heavily recruited ethnic minorities, Buddhists and other non-Christians, people of color who were colonized by Russia more than a century ago. A video on YouTube shows a visitor spinning prayer wheels at a Buddhist temple in the Siberian Republic of Buryatia. Vladimir Budayev grew up here and is vice president of the Free Buryatia Foundation. His group says 75 times as many people from this rural region have died fighting in Ukraine than those from Moscow.
In Buryatia, there is no people who didn't lose someone in this war, a relative or friend or a person who they know.
Budayev says the military manipulates young people, often straight out of high school, to sign up by telling them they'll be placed somewhere safe, away from the war, like a military base.
However, after those young men would sign a contract, they can do whatever they want with them. So, of course, they would be sent on the front line and die.
Many are still going voluntarily, though, and remain committed to fighting for Russia until the bitter end. I found a video of young Russian soldiers hiding out on the dirt floor of a shack somewhere near the front line, recording a goodbye note for their families. I just want to tell my wife and kids that I love you so much, and please don't worry. Even if we don't make it, Russia is going to win this war, he says. Many Russians flee these deadly situations. Rights groups estimate tens of thousands of Russians have broken away from the army. One deserter, interviewed by the Russian independent news outlet Novaya Gazeta, appears on camera in a hooded sweatshirt with his face blackened out to hide his identity.
Но больше было страшно за то, что ты умираешь как российский солдат.
He says, I realized that dying as a Russian soldier, that would be worse than death itself, because of the shame I felt fighting in this war. Jan Slavitsky from St. Petersburg has helped Russian soldiers who fled abroad. He says, Russian army deserters are in a really difficult position. They're considered criminals in Russia, and many countries don't want to give them asylum. Despite the dangers, an estimated 30,000 Russians still join the military every month. Many are lured by generous financial bonuses they receive for signing up. We're talking up to tens of thousands of dollars. Vladimir Budayev says the offers are just too big for many to turn down.
They're trying to survive to earn money. And unfortunately, Putin has the resources. They might need like another 300,000 men. And where would they get it? Ethnic republics and other poor regions.
Russia has a significant manpower advantage over Ukraine. Moscow has silenced its critics, even mothers of dead soldiers, to keep fighting this war. But 4 years later, even that hasn't been enough to defeat Ukraine. For the world, I'm Levi Bridges.
Artificial intelligence is advancing fast. It has proponents excited and detractors sounding alarms. Simon Hubbard is in that second camp. He runs a pub in the English city of Newcastle called the Mean-Eyed Cat.
Excellent name for a pub.
It really is. Hubbard told the BBC this week that he was tired of what he called dreadful AI slop in the artwork that appears on beer labels.
He was worried that the trend, which already offended his aesthetic sensibility, would also cause human artists to lose work. He teamed up with another local bar inside a hotel to announce a ban on AI-generated art on their products. A couple of pubs taking a stand against a global technology movement might seem ambitious.
But Hubbard says that if the announcement makes even a couple of breweries rethink their relationship with AI, it will have been worth it. Mm-hmm. Like many cities, Berlin has a pigeon problem. Some people ignore the birds, others are annoyed by them, see them as a nuisance. A group of volunteers, on the other hand, has taken to feeding and caring for the pigeons. Jamie Fullerton followed one of those caretakers to some of the city's pigeon hotspots.
Nächste Station, Alexanderplatz.
I take an inner-city train to Alexanderplatz, a busy square in Berlin with a Burger King and a massive TV tower in the center of it.
Ausstieg links.
I'm here to meet Doreen Rother and a few hundred of her feathered friends.
Good morning. Hi, how are you doing?
Just a moment.
She arrives pushing a bicycle with big bags of grain attached to the back of it. As we walk towards a grassy patch, a few pigeons begin swooping down from trees towards us.
They recognize faces very fast.
Really?
And
they recognize your face?
Yeah, definitely.
How do you know?
Because they come as soon as they see me.
Rother begins throwing grain around. Hundreds of the birds swirl in front of us, a seeding frenzy. Rother regularly feeds pigeons here and says she spends about €1,000 of her own money on supplies for the birds each month. Her pigeon obsession has an origin story. Once, on her daily commute, she noticed an injured pigeon, then over a period of weeks tried to catch it so she could help it.
When it was close enough, after some weeks, then I finally, very fast, with my hand, and then I had it. And the very next day, the foot broke off. It bled a lot, so it was really the last chance without a foot, but still could be saved. Once you open your eyes to the pigeons, you can't close them again, and you see them everywhere. You see the problems everywhere. And so, yeah, then it all started.
Most of Berlin's pigeons are descended from domestic rock pigeons rather than wild species. So Rother says humans have a responsibility to look after them. And she says that people who view pigeons as intrinsically dirty creatures are misinformed.
And they are afraid of their droppings. They say they are contagious or infectious. Almost none of those diseases can be transferred to even other birds. The possibility of infecting yourself from a pigeon is almost zero, almost.
Rother says Woody Allen is partly to blame for this pigeon PR problem. In his 1980 film Stardust Memories, Allen's character calls pigeons rats with wings.
And Woody Allen made this phrase famous in one of his movies, known all over the world. And before that, pigeons were actually the symbol of purity and of cleanliness.
It's been estimated that there are tens of thousands of pigeons living in Berlin, many of them clogging roofs and platforms in city squares and railway stations. Berlin authorities had launched a campaign promoting respectful treatment of pigeons. There was also a city plan to build a large network of roosting buildings called pigeon lofts to get bird swarms away from the public and to control the pigeon population. But in 2024, Berlin's animal welfare budget was decimated as part of wider austerity measures. So now, if you walk around central Berlin, you still see pigeons all over the place.
The problem could be solved quite easily with pigeon lofts, with doing something about breeding.
As well as feeding pigeons, Rother catches sick and injured pigeons, then takes them home for basic treatment and recovery. I watch Rother stalk a pigeon with a bent wing that's hobbling around on the pavement. Her grabbing motion is scorpion sting quick.
Yeah, she can't move her legs. I have to take her with me and bring her to the vet.
How long did it take you to learn how to catch a pigeon like that? That was like ninja skill.
It's ongoing.
The volunteer group Rother works with has about 80 members. She says that in the absence of city funding, their goal is to at least help humanely reduce the pigeon population, as well as feed and care for some of the birds. But when Rother is out and about with her grain, people often verbally attack her on the street, telling her that they hate pigeons for messing up their residential buildings.
I get insulted every day, like I'm an idiot and I should be in jail. And one person even said I should be in a concentration camp.
Is it worth it?
I think it is, yes. But it would be much, much better if we had pigeon lofts here, then they were out of sight.
Nächste Station, Südkreuz.
Rother says Berlin needs at least 100 pigeon lofts. Although city authorities won't pay for any at the moment, there are a couple of pigeon lofts in the city already, funded by donations. Rother takes me to one, built right by Südkreuz station. The pigeon loft looks like a big shipping crate with a large graffiti-style mural of a pigeon on it. It's surrounded by pretty plants and shrubs.
Come in.
Yeah.
We just close ourselves in because it's right at the train station.
People, of course, yeah.
A 17-year-old pigeon welfare volunteer named Lisa Mikkel shows me into the pigeon loft. Inside, pigeons are sitting in little containers on shelves next to stacks of bird food, bottles of medicine, and jars of anti-parasite powder.
This is like our little hospital. We find them outside here of the house. Sometimes you find them inside the house. Sometimes you find them at the train station. Or they get brought to us by just people who say, yeah, I found a pigeon. It needs help. Can I please bring it to your house?
I walk into the pigeon loft's main room. The pigeons flap around me, launching off perches or pecking grain. They can fly in and out of the pigeon loft as they please, using it as a place to roost, eat, and lay eggs. Mikkel invites me to stick my hand into a basket full of plastic fake pigeon eggs. To help keep the pigeon population down, and to not stress the birds by appearing to steal their potential offspring, the volunteers sneakily switch real pigeon eggs out of nests and put these fake ones in.
If we just let them breed here uncontrollably, there would be like a lot more pigeons and a lot more starving pigeons as well. To prevent this, we switch out the normal eggs with these ones, so the parents think, oh, they are just brooding on a normal egg, and once...
Do they always fall for it?
Yeah, pretty much.
With Berlin City's pigeon loft plan cast aside after the budget cuts, Rorta and her fellow volunteers plan to continue to fill the gap as best they can, throwing grain, grabbing sick pigeons, and running the few pigeon lofts they can afford to. I ask Rorta if she's optimistic about the future for pigeons in Berlin.
It's really hard to say at the moment. It's always about the money. And so you just can't say. Has to become better, but I'm really afraid. So I will keep on fighting, but I don't know how the future will be.
For the world, I'm Jamie Fullerton inside Südkur's Pigeon Loft, Berlin.
Get it out of here. It's probably one of those killer pigeons.
No, get something great to eat.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It was the length of a school bus, as heavy as an elephant, with fearsome jaws meant to catch and trap huge prehistoric fish. Scientists have just discovered a new dinosaur, Spinosaurus mirabilis, literally astonishing Spinosaurus. It lived about 95 million years ago, and Paul Sereno led the team of scientists who discovered its fossil in the Sahara Desert. Paul, tell me more about what this dinosaur looked like and how it moved and hunted in the world.
Well, you know, there's no animal alive today that looks exactly like it. We have to use analogy, and we actually analogize it to something that doesn't sound very fearsome, but a blue heron.
Okay.
Is what I think about in terms of the cunning, the habitat, the way it stalks, the shallows, and how good of a fisher it is. This is a kind of animal that's, we don't have anything like it in North America. It had the strongest forelimbs of any bipedal animal that ever graced the surface of the earth.
Oh, wow.
You would not want to get near it. It had a sail like we've never seen on any land animal, huge. It extended over the tail, but it was peaked over the back,
and
a sail
is sort of this like fan thing over that goes along the spine. Is that right?
Yeah, it's stiff and covered in skin. I think you can't miss this dinosaur, but just in case you would miss it, this one has a scimitar-shaped crest coming from the head. It was an amazing animal, a thrill to find it.
Take me back to that moment when you did find it. I know you were in what is now, of course, the Sahara Desert. When did you know you had something that was totally new, a totally new species?
We knew it with some inkling when we cleaned the first bones. I was following a breadcrumb trail. I found a line, one line, in a 630-page monograph by a Frenchman, Hugh Four, published in 1966, trying to describe one small outcrop, a Carasaurus. And he said, I found a tooth there. But no one had ever been back 70 years ago. But in 2019, we get to the spot, get up on top of the cars with binoculars, someone spots, I think there's a little butte over there. We drive to it. It's a Carasaurus. and there's teeth laying around.
So you found this repository of fossils out in the middle of the desert days from, from the nearest human, it sounds like.
And then we thought, well, okay, maybe that's the end of the story. And then in walks a guy out of some kind of Marvel story. He's a Tuareg Marvel figure. It's 120 degrees. This guy's wearing a black overcoat. He's got a shesh sunglasses, a sword, and he's driving a Honda motorcycle. And he says, I can tell you where some big bones are. I asked him a few more questions, and I look at him. I don't know. There's something about this guy. Let's follow him. So the next day we head out trying to keep up with this motorcycle. We thought maybe, we weren't even sure we were in Niger. We thought maybe we had made a mistake. And then he drives up, and in front of his motorbike, there is the biggest femur, and it's black. The biggest femur I'd ever seen, this thigh bone, in my life.
It was just sitting there in the middle of the desert, not under sand or anything?
Middle of the desert, and he knew where it was.
Wow.
And it's a new animal. We haven't named it yet.
So this is not the dinosaur in question. This is a different new dinosaur you discovered?
A different new one. And we scurry around, and we find the bones coming out of the ground of another new one. And then we grab this bone. We don't know what it is. I mean, it looks weird. We would later understand that this is the base of a crest. And totally understandable. We didn't know what it was. No one had seen a crest like this. We knew this was potentially a huge discovery, and we had to get back. But then the pandemic hit.
So you'd found one bone of this dinosaur, and you thought it was something new, but you needed to get back there to discover the rest of it and actually be able to name it.
And quite frankly, there might not have been any more. And so the odds are maybe we wouldn't find any more, but I couldn't take that chance. So I'm in 22. I'm figuring out where we put the tents, and Dan Vidal, my Spanish colleague, comes running up. It's here, the skull. 2 days later, we're all hovered around looking at the species of a century. I mean, it was an awe-inspiring moment we'll never forget.
It sounds very awe-inspiring. Why is this the find of a century that you say? What does this reshape about our understanding about this kind of dinosaur?
Yeah, so every once in a while, there's a behavioral question that is of great interest that you can actually answer from the fossil record when fossils are very reluctant to give you behavior. They'll give you morphology. They'll give you height, length. They might give you diet. But trying to understand whether something's a stalker of the beach or a swimmer of the deep, that is a question that sometimes you can argue about forever. But when you find a new species with a display crest that's unbelievable in the middle of a continent sitting right next to a couple of large animals I just described to you, with fossil wood, with a super fish, with everything that's freshwater, in a forested river deposit, you have just pretty much settled that question.
You mentioned the pivotal role that this man who took you to this fossil area played in your discovery of these fossils. He, and presumably perhaps others, already knew it was there. How do you think about the word discovery in that context? And do you think that you discovered this dinosaur, or that you named it and described it scientifically when others for a long time have known it was there?
I think that Your question begs something even more basic to paleontology. I've answered a question I'm very interested in. I fortunately got to the Sahara before Jurassic Park and before iPhones. Today, there's a lot more information. And so there's also information that fossils are worth money. And so we're in a bit of a race against the ravaging and the scavenging that goes on when we're one of the rare countries, unlike Niger, that puts dollar signs on patrimony like that. Niger says they belong to the people. And so in that sense, no, of course I didn't discover it. And my job in Niger is to understand and communicate what do they want. It's the final stage of the dinosaur evolution when the world divided to become the continents that we know today. And what happened on Africa, the kinds of animals that live there, that is Niger's story to tell. We are going to name dozens of behemoths. It is the last continent to do that on. And you know what this man is very proud of? He is really proud of bringing out the secrets of his land and hoping that the world finds them and sees them and understands them, to relish
this part of Earth's history that they have and they have alone.
Paul Sereno is a paleontologist at the University of Chicago. He led the international team that discovered the new dinosaur species, Spinosaurus mirabilis.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org and check out more of our original reporting on YouTube. We are at The World News GBH. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.